I guess you remember reading in the newspapers last fall how some communists were kicked out of the CIO when they tried to push the American worker into following a country like Russia.
I sure do remember that, George, and always was kind of curious about just what happened there.
Well, here's what happened, Bill. We of the CIO don't give a row of beans, you know, for what people want to think for themselves. If they're crazy enough to want to believe in communism, well, we're not going to stop them. When they start hurting the American labor movement, that's when CIO draws a line. And for the last 10 years, those communists have done just about everything bad they could think to try to kill labor in this country. They told lies and misled the people and even tried to get them to vote in elections against the right kind of candidates. At the CIO convention last November, the communists stood up and screamed things at the CIO leaders, which if they had been in Russia, well, they'd just been taken out and shot for doing it. Yes, Bill, they took advantage of the freedoms we have in order to take those freedoms away from us. But let me tell you, they didn't get to first base. As a matter of fact, after hitting all those foul balls, they struck out. The 6 million members of the CIO, through their delegates at the convention, voted to kick the communists out. And since the CIO is a democratic organization, all the members, through their delegates, made their will known. And their will was done.
Well, George, I sure am right proud of this country. In fact, right at this minute, I'm about to pop a shirt button with pride in the American workers and the CIO because they knew enough to protect us and all of our liberties.
Welcome to Organize the Unorganized. Though on this episode, this title is hardly a source of inspiration. This podcast is still from the Center for Work and Democracy and Jacobin Magazine, and I'm still your host, Benjamin Fong. 1947 brought the disastrous Taft-Hartley Bill, which, in labor strategist Rich Gieselson's words, codified a series of legal landmines that forced unions to weigh the political and economic costs of doing anything too aggressive in their efforts to grow, and indeed to begin fighting many rearguard actions to protect the gains they had already made. This included prohibitions on a variety of strike activity and boycotting, the allowance for states to pass so-called right-to-work laws, and a requirement that union officers sign non-communist affidavits with the government. It would be too much to get into the many, varied consequences of Taft-Hartley, which many have argued was a repeal of the Wagner Act in everything but name. But for my purposes, two crucial things happened in 1947. First, much of what had been either legally sanctioned or in a legal gray area for the prior 15 years was finally made illegal. And second, the ideological antagonisms within the CIO that had been exploited constructively in the early years would finally turn destructive. Here's Lisbeth Cohen describing the fine line that the communists walked within the CIO from the very beginning.
I think that the Communist Party's members who helped with the unionization in many of the industrial workplaces in the United States, it was crucial that they had a lot of skill, they were very focused, but they also allied with local leaders, and that is important. This is not just an outsider's campaign, and that is a really important lesson, I think, that you need to have people who speak to the local community who are viewed as part of their world, not just outsiders. And there were limits to how much the CIO would tolerate communist activism. So someone like John Lewis, who was the head of the CIO, was somewhat anti-communist, and he would not have tolerated their participation, I think, if it had been more strident. So I do think they walked a very fine line and contributed tremendously. What would happen after the war with the passage of anti-union legislation like Taft-Hartley is that unions that had become more identified as radical, communist-leaning, if not Communist Party-dominated, like United Electrical Workers and packing house workers, would find that the Taft-Hartley Act would actually force the most radical workers to be disowned in a sense, that they had to sign pledges that they were not communists. This is, of course, the Cold War era, McCarthyism and so forth. So many of the communist union leaders who survived and had been able to sort of orient those unions to a more left-leaning agenda found themselves purged in the McCarthy period. So I think that the party walked, as I said, a very fine line and contributed in significant ways, and I don't think could have probably been much more radical and allowed these unions to succeed as they did.
According to James Young, this early period of tolerance of the communists came to an end with the departure of John L. Lewis.
One source that I tend to trust, a reporter from the 1930s and 40s, held that from his taking power as head of the CIO, Murray, who was president of the CIO from 1940 to 50, till he died in 52, was allegedly reluctant, in fact, said he would not take that presidency unless he could work on getting rid of the communists. And whoever was in power, say yes or no to that demand, said yes, sure.
But Murray would only fully act on this demand after the war, amidst anti-communist scaremongering. For Melvin Dubofsky, however, the real issue was not communism, but the left-led CIO union's support for Progressive Party candidate Henry Wallace in the 1948 presidential election.
After the war, there's a conservative reaction. Republicans take over power in Congress after the 1946 election. That's how you get the Taft-Hartley law. Then you have what could be called the onset of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And then in the 1948 election, you have a third party whose candidate is Henry Wallace, who had been Roosevelt's vice president for two terms. Wallace leads the Progressive Party. The Progressive Party gains the support of the CIO's red union. The CIO's leadership is upset, not because its red unions seem favorable to the Soviet Union and are outside of the Cold War consensus, but the CIO's leadership is disturbed because they see Wallace and the Progressive Party as a threat to New Deal dominance. They fear that the Progressive Party will take support away from Harry Truman in 1948 and throw the presidential election to the Republicans. CIO in 48 had adopted as organizational policy and principle support for the election of Harry Truman and the Democrats. Its red unions had refused to follow policy. And that is really why CIO acts against them. If they had supported Truman and the Democratic Party, I suspect at least in 1948, that the CIO leadership would not have acted to expel them.
For James Matlis of the UE, communism served as a front for a number of issues. In a speech from 1973, he also cited the tension around the 1948 presidential election, but traced the basic conflict back to 1946 and the failure of the CIO to recommit to organizing the unorganized after the war.
In March of that year, an important event took place. Westinghouse was still on strike. A man by the name of Winston Churchill came from England. And he came to a town in Fulton, Missouri to address a meeting with the President of the United States, Harry Truman, next to him. And he enunciated the Cold War, the fight against world communism, and declared unrelenting war on the Soviet Union, the ally in the Second World War. And in the middle of that strife, while we were still on the picket lines, this Union came out with a blast against Churchill, came out with a blast against the monopolists in this country, and said that this is going to be a disaster for the world and a disaster for America. And it's a Cold War started by American monopolists, and that the American people were going to pay dearly. And by the time we arrived to the Atlantic City Convention, the first convention after the war in Atlantic City in 1946, the CIO was already beginning to be ripped asunder on the issue of communism. And this union, the ILWU, and 8 other unions of the CIO condemned that. But there is a fable going around in the American labor movement and in the country that the issue between UE and CIO was foreign policy, and that the UE was kicked out of the CIO because it supported Russia against America. That's a slander that has been going on for more than a quarter of a century. The issue was not that at all. At 46, we stood up at that convention, the UE, and we said the CIO is abandoning its militancy, it's abandoning its dedication, it's abandoning its rank-and-file unionism, it's abandoning its efforts to organize, whereby in 1937 we organized 2 million people. In 1946, the CIO organized 300,000 people, and 20% of that was organized by the UE. And we stood up there and said, we are not satisfied with that. And we better get off our swivel chairs and get down to the factory gates, or the CIO will go down the drain. We were stuck with about 4 million members, and there were 25 more million workers to be organized. And the CIO was already being converted into statesmanship for those who carried on during the war by rubbing shoulders with American big industry and big government, got to like the good life. And by the time that war was over, if it wasn't for the rank and file militancy in 46, that strike would never have taken place. Let no one kid himself. No leadership could probably have stood up front of those workers and kept them in those plans. They would have been run over like by a bulldozer. There was no choice that the leadership had, and that would apply to steelworkers, automobile, or UE. If the UE leadership tried to hold back that way, we would be run down to death. That's the feeling among the workers. Well, by the end of 46, the CIO was already on the way to hell.
Many of my guests felt as if the break with the left-led unions and the CIO was inevitable. Eric Loomis.
The eviction of the communist unions is something that was probably inevitable. I don't think there's actually a way that the American labor movement survives in any form that it looks like today if this doesn't happen, because you have to remember that it's not just the Taft-Hartley passed, right? It passed with overwhelming support that were like massive overrides of Truman's veto. I mean, it's not like it was close, right? So like, you know, the unions had very little support in American public life in 1947. So it becomes very easy, I think, to say, well, you know, the CIO screwed up by evicting the communist unions. Maybe it did. Maybe it didn't. Maybe they need to do that just to survive.
Even before 1948, David Brody and Eric Loomis believed that the communists had lost a great deal of trust with their changing political positions.
The great problem that the party had was that the shifts from one position to another weren't dictated by the conditions that existed in the U.S., but that were determined by sort of an international conditions or their interpretation of how to act. And you see this particularly after, in 1939, when there was this agreement between Hitler and Stalin, and suddenly the communists changed direction, and their people in the unions had to do likewise. In 1941, when Russia was invaded by Germany, it was reversed, and the communists became determined that there should be no strikes or disruption of defense or production. And during World War II, they were vehemently against the violations of no strike pledge. So this was a kind of party dynamic.
I think that communists hurt themselves a lot. That's a big part of the story, too, is that the communists hurt themselves consistently, right? That whole debate in the 70s and in the 80s, people who said that the Communist Party were taking orders from Moscow were a bunch of, you know, red baiters. And then the archives opened in Moscow, and lo and behold, they were in fact taking orders from Moscow, right? So I think that it is important that we recognize this. And what this really gets to, what this means, especially when you're talking about foreign policy issues, we're moving up toward World War II, which, I mean, if you look at union newspapers, for instance, from the 30s, for these early CIO newspapers, yes, they're about the industry and they're about local conditions, but they have like significant foreign policy coverage because they're trying to educate workers around these issues, right? But when the orders come from Moscow to change positions, especially around, you know, around Germany, and then like other workers are like, what the heck is going on here? Like yesterday they said this, why, you know, I mean, this term wasn't really used at the time, but like it's gaslighting, right? They're like, what is even happening here? And so you have a lot of workers that were at one time favorable to a lot of what the Communist Party was doing in their union, stop trusting them.
That the communists were secretive and often vying for power in local elections did not help in this regard. James Young and Jeremy Brecker.
Well, the communists were not the best friends, always, of democracy. And the unions, the CIO unions, they did pretty well in that connection. But organizations evolve, and not all of them stayed democratic by any means. So there was that. I think they erred in subverting their membership identity. Because, you know, then when they could be exposed, you know, as members or as simply having been a member, you know, just reinforced the propaganda from the right and from employers. I think, you know, if they'd been a little more upfront about their politics, I think they might have fared less harshly anyway. I don't know how much difference it would have made in the long run. They're keeping secret their membership, even their connection, say, caused a good deal of negative attack that could have been avoided or at least nuanced a little bit.
Communists had their own bastions within some of the unions. The one that I've studied most deeply, it was the mine mill and smelter workers, where they had major leadership roles and major organizing power, not nearly as much at a grassroots level. And there were actually rank and file movements against the communist domination of the movement. These were not ideologically right wing. These would be people who saw themselves as mainstream CIO and who were puzzled by why Lewis and his associates would allow their union to be dominated by a communist clique. I did many interviews in this area, and there they went to one of Lewis's top associates and said, why do we have these communists dominating our union? And the answer was, we know what the situation is. You're good boys. We like you. But this isn't the time to move. We have it under control. Just go back home. We'll take care of it.
And they eventually did. Here is some of the debate from the convention floor on the resolution concerning the effective expulsion of the communists from the CIO in November 1949. The resolution would be introduced by George Baldanzi, vice president of the Textile Workers Union of America, who you heard bantering with singer Bill Strength at the beginning of this episode. Speaking against the resolution, president of the Fur and Leather Workers Union, Ben Gold.
I ask you, have you got any charges against my union? Can you prove with one word whether I personally or my union ever conducted itself contrary to the interests of CIO. But isn't it correct that you are uniting now with the Taft and the Hartleys and those that want to deprive labor of their rights?
Speaking for the resolution, President of the Textile Workers Union of America, Emil Reavy.
I don't think that we ought to fool ourselves any longer by talking about unity, about democracy, because those that talk the loudest do the least about these two subject matters. I am perfectly willing to give to the communists and the fascists, and to me they both like two peas in a pot, always have been, there never was any difference between them. I'll give them the type of the democracy that they are willing to give me if they were in power. Unity, democracy, what crimes are committed in their name. I can't see worse things in life than unity. They have unity in Czechoslovakia. They have unity in Russia. I don't want any part of that kind of a unity.
Speaking against the resolution, President of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, Harry Bridges.
Communism. Why, communism is not the issue. It's the issue that we argued about in the last 18 months. And that is no opposition in the CIO. No minority opposition. Oh, sure, you can speak all right. You can take your positions. But when you vote in your unions, make sure you vote right. That's not opposition. That's regimentation. The ILWU has no plans to leave CIO. The ILWU has no plans to leave this convention. To get rid of us, you're going to have to throw us out.
And finally, speaking for the resolution, President of the United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther.
The body politic has a bad case of cancer. And we've either got to save the cancer or the body. The noisy minority believes that we ought to throw away the body and save the cancer. And we have come here to cut out the cancer and save the body of CIO. Some of the brothers who stand on the floor of this convention and would have you believe that they are God's gift to the working class. All I can say is, Harry, your halo is on crooked today. Because we also know that these fellows who talk about the class struggle, who talk about dialectical materialism, who think that they alone are among the anointed to lead the workers out of the wilderness, we remember that when the party line dictated that they were talking about a 5-year no-strike pledge, they were going to make love to all the fat capitalists in Wall Street.
Unsurprisingly, the resolution passed. In a kind of ritual humiliation, members like Ben Gold tried to reapply to the Executive Council, only to be rejected publicly for his communist ties.
The chairman, by unanimous vote of the delegates representing our union at this convention, I wish to place the name and nomination for a member of the Executive Board of International President Ben Gold.
Chair is compelled to rule by virtue of the provisions of the Constitution of the CIO that Brother Gold will be ineligible to serve as a member of the CIO Executive Board under our present Constitution.
The CIO was effectively over. But there's one last bit to cover before getting to the merger with the AFL, and that is the CIO's failed effort to organize the South, beginning with the launch of Operation Dixie in 1946. William Jones.
So Operation Dixie was a campaign that was launched by the CIO. The AFL also launched at the same time a campaign along the same lines to organize in the South out of a recognition that between the mid-1930s and mid-1940s, unions had expanded dramatically, you know, more quickly than they had in any other period in American history. But that expansion was largely confined to the industrial Northeast. So there was a recognition of the need to extend that growth and the power of unions into the South, which was a region that was, by the Second World War, and certainly coming out of the Second World War, a place where unions had established some beachheads, but still were not nearly as powerful or influential as they were in the industrial Northeast. So it was a campaign launched by the CIO aimed at organizing the major Southern industries. So it focused on textiles, on lumber, on mining, and also some smaller, you know, the auto industry to the extent that it operated in the South, and steel. But I think some people would say it was a complete failure. In part, I think the memory of it as a failure is based upon the assumption that was held by many CIO leaders that the most important industry to organize was textiles. There were some textile mills that were organized by it, but it largely had very little impact on the textile industry. At the same time, I think there were places in which it was pretty successful. I've written about the lumber industry, in which unions were established that had a big influence on the industry. There were also places in which CIO unions established really a lot of influence in the tobacco industry and in the packing house industry, but those were much smaller than the textiles.
For Jones, Operation Dixie leaders did not want to take on both Jim Crow and intransigent employers, and this was to the campaign's detriment.
Some within the CIO took the position that they would try to organize people sort of without attention to race, organize around sort of common goals of workers, economic justice, what we might think of as sort of economic liberalism, the idea that people have shared interests in better wages and better working conditions, and not really talk about race out of fear of alienating white workers, some of whom were allied with white supremacist organizations. The top leadership of Operation Dixie, they made a lot of statements saying, you know, we're not interested in addressing racial inequality. That's not, you know, that's somebody else's fight. We're here to build unions. And I think everybody recognized that that was a rhetorical position that didn't really have any reality on the ground, right? I mean, you can imagine that organizing in Georgia in 1946, you're not going to avoid race, right? I mean, but this was the way in which they talked about it, trying to allay people's concerns that this was going to be a sort of all-out campaign against Jim Crow that would certainly have touched off an even bigger backlash than it did. It's much harder to find people explicitly saying, yeah, we are going to take on race. And I think that was a position that came up largely from Black union members. The idea of just ignoring race wouldn't have made much sense to them. And so you see it articulated mostly in unions where, whether they're in the leadership or they're just in a really significant portion of the membership, Black workers have some influence.
The South posed an organizing problem for the CIO, but it was also a political problem. Melvin Dubofsky.
The South was the big problem, not only because Southern-based industries fought unions, but in the South, elections were controlled by a minority of voters. And the Southern congressional delegations in the House and the Senate that were Democratic in name were Republican in sympathy and action. And so Congress was dominated by a Republican and Southern Democratic coalition. There were some Southern Democrats that were outside that coalition, but the South as a whole was the area that could break union influence and power. When Operation Dixie failed, and it failed abysmally. CIO was left helpless as an independent organization. And with Republican and Southern influence in Congress and national politics rising, with Taft-Hartley in place, and Taft-Hartley did more to cripple the Red CIO unions than their expulsion from CIO did. CIO said, well, it's really time now.
And so we finally come to merger. Philip Murray had passed away in 1952, at which point Walter Reuther finally ascended to the presidency of the CIO. But for all the reasons just covered, he now presided over a very different organization from the CIO of his youth. Basically, from the moment he took over, he was fated to return to the House of Labor. And so in 1955, the CIO would reunite with the AFL to form the AFL-CIO, the labor federation that has persisted to this day. The CIO contingent would be only a minority faction from the beginning, but they did have one key platform in the new federation, the Industrial Union Department. Jeremy Brecker.
Within the merged AFL-CIO, although the AFL became dominant quite rapidly, the old CIO unions continued with the Industrial Union Council and continued to try to function independently in a separate way and do things that were different, like coordinated bargaining between different unions in the same industry, like support the March on Washington and the civil rights movement, and other things that were very much out of line with George Meany and the American Federation of Labor traditions.
While George Meany, president of the AFL-CIO and the AFL-CIO executive board, did not support the 1963 March on Washington, the Industrial Union Department did, and Walter Reuther not only spoke at the march, but contributed significant financial sums to it as well. This represents the broader contribution of the CIO moment to the civil rights movement, one that many of my guests discussed. William Jones.
It wasn't just within the CIO, but there were a number of CIO unions in which Black activists gained significant influence and power during the Second World War. The Auto Workers Union, particularly in the large plants in Detroit, where there were a number of Black activists and workers, several of the needle trades unions, the Packing House Workers Union. And in these places, you know, Black workers used the infrastructure of the labor movement, both the AFL and the CIO, as vehicles for the civil rights movement. And they sort of turned it into these allies for the civil rights movement. And that would become even more important in the 1950s as the union movement reached its pinnacle of power and really became a political powerhouse in the United States. And Black workers sort of shifted its attention to fighting for racial equality.
Nelson Lichtenstein recounted the experience of organizing Ford in the 1940s and how it laid the groundwork for civil rights activism.
One of the crucial moments in the CIO's history came in 1941 during the Ford strike. Henry Ford had hired lots of Black workers. He went to the Black churches and he thought they'd be loyal, and they were loyal to Ford. They were better jobs than you could get somewhere else. But during the strike, the auto workers knew they had to get Black workers involved. They got in touch with the NAACP, and there was kind of an alliance. And basically, Black workers were being strike breakers, but over the course of the strike, they sort of convinced them not to be. And there were lots of Black workers in the Ford organization. And so by 1943, Black workers, you know, were at the core of one of the most militant unions, you know, in the country, in Local 600, and which had like 80,000 workers at one point. And just became a sort of cockpit of civil rights activism in the Midwest.
For Lisa Phillips, we're only today beginning to fully appreciate the connections between the labor and civil rights movements.
The way historians have written about the civil rights movement as if it were devoid of any kind of understanding of organizing and wages, and it's just wrong. The very newest scholarship is going back and looking at, say, Martin Luther King's emphasis on economic organizing throughout the entirety of his career, right? And how he had to downplay that because of fears of being brought up before Hewitt, you know, and all those things. that McCarthy era was so devastating for so many reasons, but also because of the way the scholarship separated the labor movement from the civil rights movement as if they didn't coexist. When you look at Black organizers, you can see that from the 30s on, that was a consistent connection between civil rights and labor rights.
In December of 1961, Martin Luther King addressed the AFL-CIO in a recently digitized speech.
Labor's next monumental struggle emerged in the 30s, when it wrote into federal law the right freely to organize and bargain collectively. And yet the Wagner Act, like any other legislation, tended merely to declare rights but did not deliver them. Labor had to bring the law to life by exercising in practice its rights over stubborn, tenacious opposition. It was warned to go slow, to be moderate, not to stir up trouble. But labor knew it was always the right time to do right. And it spread its organization over the nation and achieved equality organizationally with capital. The day of economic democracy was born. Negroes in the United States, read this history of labor and find that it mirrors our own experience. We are confronted by powerful forces telling us to rely on the goodwill and understanding of those who profit by exploiting us. They deplore our discontent. They resent our will to organize so that we may guarantee that humanity will prevail and equality will be exacted. They are shocked that action organizations, sit-ins, civil disobedience, and protests are becoming our everyday tools, just as strikes, demonstrations, and union organization became yours to ensure that bargaining power genuinely existed on both sides of the table. Labor's historic tradition of moving forward to create vital people as consumers and citizens has become our own tradition, and for the same reasons. This unity of purpose is not an historical coincidence. Negroes are almost entirely a working people. There are pitifully few Negro millionaires and few Negro employers. Our needs are identical with labor's needs: decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, old age security, health and welfare measures, conditions in which families can grow, have education for their children, and respect in the community. That is why Negroes support labor's demands and fight laws which curb labor. That is why the labor hater and labor beta is virtually always a twin-headed creature spewing anti-Negro epithets from one mouth and anti-labor propaganda from the other mouth.
That vision laid out by King at the end there should sound familiar. Full employment, expansion of labor's power, and broad social welfare reform. It was the plan laid out by the CIO at the end of the war, and also the one animating the 1963 March on Washington. Civil rights plus full employment equals freedom, read one sign at the march. Liberal politicians like John F. Kennedy also understood full employment as the unfinished task of the CIO moment. Here's Kennedy addressing the Packing House Workers Union in September 1963.
Here in the United States, we have the task, it seems to me, of building on the what was done in the 30s and has been on occasions done since then, and that is establish a platform or a framework of life for all of our citizens, which will permit us to move steadily ahead with full employment without the recurrent recessions which have disturbed our life in the post-war period. Now, we don't have the answer to all of that, but I think it's within our reach. We have gone since the end of 1945, mostly because of what was done in the 30s, without the kinds of depressions which marked the post-World War I era. All of the things which I think have brought us relative prosperity since 45 have been due to the very hard and difficult fights in which this union and other unions were involved in the 30s. And the things now which all Americans take for granted were as controversial as any proposals and more controversial than anything we're now discussing today.
Before I close out, it's worth noting that many of my guests, unprompted, took time to reflect on what it meant to be telling the story of the CIO today. Steve Frazier.
You would ask this question in, say, the 1960s, what's the significance of the CIO? It would be a different answer than you'll get today, I think. In the 60s, it would have been a more ambivalent response because then the CIO obviously had made an enormous achievement in winning industrial democracy for large sections of the industrial working class. No one would deny that. But there was also this notion that it had short-circuited more revolutionary developments, that something called corporate liberalism had co-opted what might have been the more far-reaching attempts by the CIO to really challenge capitalism. And that's because at that moment in the 60s and past the 60s, the enemy, so to speak, seemed to be a kind of liberalism which was under assault from a lot of different directions because of its behavior in the world, in Vietnam and in race matters and so on and so forth. You ask that question today when liberalism is itself under attack by the right and the CIO emerges as a bastion of democracy, a great democratic achievement, and it was. And one looks back at that with a kind of yearning that that could happen again today, especially given the deindustrialization and deunionization of so many sections of the working class today. And no one worries too much about what might have been the revolutionary, or let us say more than strictly collective bargaining potential of the CIO back in the 1930s. And maybe both those things are true. That is to say, that it may be that in the 30s, more was possible than was achieved, but that what was achieved was enormously important in ensuring democracy among large sections of the population for whom a voice had been denied for generations, so that one might have a kind of mixed assessment of the CIO's significance.
Ruth Milkman also spoke of the changing perspectives on this moment.
You know, I'll tell you another story about this guy called Clyde Summers, who's dead now, but who was a very eminent labor lawyer who taught at University of Pennsylvania for many years in the law school. I met him once at some conference, and I was like the entertainment at the conference, like a non-legal person who they wanted to talk to about stuff. And this was not in the actual official proceedings, but on the side in some meal or something, he says to me, "You know, Ruth," and he came of age in the 30s. He said, "In my day, labor law and by implication, labor studies or whatever was a field for romantics. Now it's a field for masochists." And this was probably in the 80s or early 90s that we had this conversation, but it really stayed with me. Like there was something transformative about this moment. I mean, it's all the stuff put together, not any one thing, but the sit down strikes, the Wagner Act, the New Deal itself, regulation. FDR, you know, after living through the biggest crisis that capitalism has ever experienced, the Great Depression of the 1930s, you know, this is a thrilling time for the people who participated in it. And I think that romance kind of lives on, at least for a while, into the late 20th century among people like me who kind of get interested in labor history. I mean, you know, there's something magical about it that we haven't really seen since. You know, it's sort of when all the stars line up, which doesn't happen too often in labor history.
As is evident in the sometimes conflicting views of my guests on this podcast, there's many ways to tell the story of the CIO, depending on the moment that you're in and what your ideological commitments are. For some, it's a story of unprecedented success. For others, it's one of constraint and bureaucratization. For the working people of America, however, it constituted a transformation of working and living standards, and perhaps this is the best way to remember the CIO. Dorothy Sue Cobble.
I always thought that Jack Metzger made a great point in his book on striking steel. He looked at the way that the CIO transformed the lives of his parents and his family, how they made it possible for them to live a life where there was economic security, where they had health care, where they didn't have to suffer the tyrannical whims of a foreman, where the union actually provided them with the beginnings of decision-making, joint decision-making and some power in the workplace, where they had mechanisms to participate politically. All of these changes were really significant. And he ended up saying, if this isn't revolution, I don't know what is.
Thank you for joining me on this penultimate episode of Organize the Unorganized. At the end of my interviews with all of the guests on this program, I asked a simple question, which was this: what lessons can we draw from the CIO for the present moment? On the final episode next week, I'll give you their answers. Till then.
Is there an ending to the CIO? Of course not. For it is more than an organization, a name, a set of initials. There can be no end to the unions built and strengthened under the banner of the CIO, to the gains won, to the pensions being paid, to the ideals instilled, and to the friendships formed.